This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate, then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy. Futuro.
From Futuro Media and PRX, it's Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. Today, Suave, the podcast, episode 2. A story about juveniles sentenced to die in prison, told through one man's journey. David Luis Suave Gonzalez was sentenced to mandatory life in prison without parole for a crime committed when he was 17 years old. He was found guilty of first-degree homicide. Today we bring you episode 2 of Futuro Studios' newest podcast, a story of incarceration, redemption, and the very special, nearly three-decade-long relationship between a man convicted of murder and a journalist, me. For this story, producer Maggie Freeling is coming along with me. And just a warning that this episode contains some strong language that is not bleeped.
So Maria, over those years of phone calls when Suave was in prison, one thing you spent a lot of time talking about was Suave's childhood.
Yeah, I mean, because look, he was a kid when he went into prison. So those are the only memories he had was of his childhood. But very specifically, he was doing a lot of thinking about his mom.
So what did you actually know about her?
So I remember thinking that Suave's mom was really complicated.
My mother grew up in the Bronx. She grew up in the streets. She grew up hustling. My mother was like the black sheep of the family.
Maria Gonzalez was born in Puerto Rico in 1942. She moved to New York with her family when she was a young girl. Suave and his twin sister were her fourth and fifth kids, and they were born in the Bronx in 1969. His mom would have one more child, and she'd also raise her sister's kid.
So she's raising these little kids in the 1970s in New York City in the South Bronx. There was like gang violence, like tons of crime. The city was so deeply in debt that banks had stopped lending the city money. There were these constant fires raging all across the South Bronx. I mean, it was a crazy time in New York City.
In them times, the Bronx was the Bronx.
A new Federal Census Bureau study has revealed that this area, South Bronx, is the poorest in the whole nation. Worse than Watts. Worse than rural Mississippi. Worse than Appalachia. For years, the name has been a way of saying poverty, unemployment, hellish crime.
And Suave's family, his mom, was like right in the middle of it.
My house was the spot where all the kids came and smoked weed. We had a whole bunch of sex workers from Hutspawn hanging in our house. For those that don't know what Hutspawn used to be back in the 80s, Hutspawn was like the mecca for prostitution in the South Bronx in the 80s.
Did your mom do sex work?
I don't know, but that's the crowd she attracted. They used to do shit in the street and come hide in my house. And my mom used to let them.
Suave's mom raised her seven kids on her own. Suave says the men who fathered his other siblings were also absent. His mom did all the parenting. But Suave says even though they were always poor, they never went hungry.
She believed, like, if I don't feed my kids, no, who's going to feed them? So I got to go out and hustle. And hustling to her meant cashing checks, forging checks, selling diabetic syringes, you know, anything that was illegal my mother did. And there's no shame in that because she took care of us to the best of her ability.
In some ways, Suave idolized her. And although she couldn't provide everything he wanted,
she could provide for me a way how to hustle, how to get the lifestyle. You want more, then you got to go do this.
And Suave totally wanted the lifestyle.
At an early age, I used to take green lipstick and try to act like I had tattoos and fascinated with the lifestyle. I was fascinated with Scarface, Tony Montana.
Say hello to my little friend!
That's how I want to be. That's how you get the street credibility. You know, I'm going to be the baddest dude on the block.
In 1980, when Suave turned 11, New York City saw more violent crimes than any other year in the city's history. 1980 was also a really tough year for Suave personally. He was having behavior problems at school. He'd been in and out of visits with counselors and psychiatrists. And an evaluator with the New York Board of Education made this observation.
He is illiterate. He feeds himself, but needs help dressing and bathing. He cannot handle money. He cannot socialize or travel independently. Behavior is not age appropriate. Functioning at the mild mental retardation level, he demonstrates cultural deprivation.
They recommended Suave transfer to special classes and see a therapist weekly. And then that year of violence gets personal for Suave.
So Suave's grandfather, his abuelito, was a barber, and his shop was in the heart of East Harlem, in Spanish Harlem. So Suave would come down from the South Bronx every week to get a lineup from his grandpa at his barber shop. Except that one day when he went to get his haircut, everything changed.
Well, can you tell me exactly what happened? What happened on that day?
His partner walked in the barbershop, getting my wiggly haircut. And some type of business problem with his buddy. He walked in while he was giving me my haircut and shot him. Shot him in the stomach. And said, hey, boom, just shot him. Really didn't say much. Just shot him. And I seen my grandfather. I knew he was dead when he fell because his eyes rolled back. I seen plenty of them in the neighborhood. So, and that was the day that I always say, you know, I kind of lost, like, all sense of reality for me. Like, you killed my grandfather, so I'm entitled to kill somebody else, too. If I'm hurting, somebody gonna hurt. That was my mom friend at that time.
So, by the time you were 12 years old, how many drugs had you done?
Quite a few. It started me smoking weed right after my grandfather died. And from there, went to Angel Dust.
Who turned you on to Angel Dust? I mean, you didn't know.
My friends in the neighborhood. This is better than pot. Try this. And I just liked it.
Because?
It allowed me to get wow. It allowed me to forget things.
Suave says that year he also tried heroin for the first time.
I used to sell dope. And I told my mom, yo, I want to try this shit. She said, all right, let's try it. That's it.
That's what I remember him saying. And I was just like, what kind of a mom would do that to her son or with her son? But, you know, things start to get peeled back. I begin to kind of understand a little bit more about Suave's mom. And I'm like, oh, my God. Whew. Her life was really tough.
My mother was a victim. Rape. And out of that incident, me and my sister was born.
In 1985, Suave says his mom got caught in a check-cashing scheme, and she moved her family to Philadelphia, running from a warrant. Suave was 16.
My mother thought she was doing something great, moving us from the South Bronx, and we end up in the worst neighborhood, probably in Philadelphia in the 80s, the Badlands, next to the graveyard. And that was like, oh my God.
Just 5 minutes off of I-95 in Philadelphia exists a notorious drug destination called the Badlands, a place where dealers sell in the open-air market.
Yeah,
The Badlands was, and still is, one of the most dangerous neighborhoods in Philadelphia. And Suave's mom moved her family directly to the center of it.
10th and Clearfield. You know, that was like the worst decision ever for me.
Suave says he lived a couple houses away from one of the most powerful drug dealers in the area, Fat Wilson. Suave says Wilson had a gang of teenagers working for him, carrying guns, selling drugs, and enforcing his dominion over, quote, his blocks.
My father figures was dudes, the drug dealers, the pimps, the people that was living large. Those was my father figures. And, you know, they wasn't telling me you got to go to school. They wasn't telling me none of that. Everything they was telling me was the opposite. You want to make some money? You got to sell this package. You want to have some nice girls, you got to have some money. You got to be the guy on the block. So I follow that path.
And then came the night that changed Suave's life forever. December 6th, 1986, a little less than a year after he moved to Philadelphia. Suave was walking with his neighbor, 13-year-old Axel Serrano. It was almost midnight on a Saturday, and Suave says they were both dealing for Fat Wilson, the neighborhood kingpin. This is when they ran into 13-year-old Danny Martinez, a neighborhood kid who worked on a rival drug block. And the only thing we know for sure about that night is that Danny was shot in the head, and he died days later in the hospital. Suave says right after the shooting, he and Axel took off running. Later, Axel's mom took him down to the police station and named Suave as the shooter. Suave was taken into custody a few days later. And so once arrested, Suave says the Philadelphia District Attorney's Office offered him a deal. If he'd testify for the prosecution, they would give him a lighter sentence.
The thing is that taking that plea would mean that you would have to point the finger at someone.
It's who tell first. That's who get the deal.
And that, you know, basically kind of being a rat in terms of the street, Suave was not prepared to do that.
And on top of that, you know, he was pretty much illiterate at the time. He says he didn't know what he was being offered.
I'm not taking that. I don't know what the heck I'm signing. Because I only saw my lawyer 2 times before trial.
Axel's cooperation with the police paid off. For pointing to Suave, he got his own charges bumped down to a more lenient juvenile court, where even if found guilty, he'd face a lighter sentence. Over a year later, Suave stood before a judge, charged as an adult with murder in the first degree, robbery, criminal conspiracy, and possession of an instrument of a crime, a gun. Only one witness spoke at his trial, a 17-year-old girl. Sharon Benjamin also lived in the Badlands, about a block away from Danny Martinez. She testified that Suave, along with Axel, had tried to rob Danny of the fuchsia, fur-trimmed bomber jacket he was wearing that night.
At maybe 10 of 11, not far from 11, I went to the store on 8th and Cambria, but it was closed. And I saw Danny on the corner.
The original trial was not recorded, so we hired actors to read from the transcripts.
He asked me where I was going, and I told him I was going to the other store because that one was closed, and he said he would walk me because it was too dark for me to walk by myself. When we got to the corner, we noticed these two people that had come and stood in front of us, so we couldn't go past. And they were standing there, and so we just stood there because we didn't know them. And the taller of the two boys said, "Take it off."
She points at Suave. Suave was tall and 135 pounds. Danny was short, only 5'2", 90 pounds. She says Suave demanded Danny give him his bomber jacket.
But Danny and I didn't know him, so we turned around to go back where we came from, and he put his hand on his shoulder. And both of us turned around to face them again, and Danny said, "What?" And then the taller boy said, "Take it off," again. But Danny didn't have a chance to respond because he had taken out a gun and had it at Danny's head and shot him.
Then Suave tells his version of the story. It's a completely different version than Sharon's. He said it was just a fight gone terribly wrong. There was no robbery.
I was coming from 5th and Somerset, a restaurant, and I was walking down Somerset Street heading back home. I was walking by the school, Edison. That's when 3 guys came out, and one of them said, "I caught you by yourself. Give it up."
Suave tells about an earlier argument on Thanksgiving with Danny and how Danny threatened that if he saw Suave again, there would be a fight. Now, that fight was about to happen. Suave says Danny wasn't alone with Sharon that night. He says Danny's friends had ganged up on him.
That's when one of the guys came up and punched me in my left eye and I fell down. I got back up and I started fighting back. That's when one of them came up with a knife and struck me in the left side of my shoulder. Then I met Axel Serrano.
Suave says Axel was standing on the corner, keeping a lookout for cops.
Axel Serrano took out a gun and he gave it to me. When he gave it to me, it just went off.
Suave says it was an accident. Two teens, Sharon and Suave, two versions of events, very little evidence for either version. But the judge believed Sharon's, and so Suave was sentenced to life in prison without the possibility of parole. To understand how Suave was convicted with such a harsh sentence without any direct physical evidence, we need to talk about the political environment at the time Suave was tried. Juvenile offenders in Philadelphia faced a district attorney's office which routinely sought the harshest punishment possible for crimes, including the death penalty. That placed tremendous power in prosecutors' hands. And one of the things the Philadelphia District Attorney's Office did was offer kids deals promising not to seek the death penalty if they gave up being tried by a jury. And so this was just one of the reasons that Philadelphia became the epicenter of the juvenile lifer population.
Now it begins to make sense. Like, why is it that there were so many juvenile lifers based in Pennsylvania?
Over 500 juvenile lifers in Pennsylvania, and a large number of them are locked up at Graterford State Prison, where Suave is. And helping them get there was prosecutor Roger King. He was known for attaining more death penalty convictions than any other prosecutor in the city.
Roger King was a fixture trying some of the city's biggest cases. D.A. Seth Williams calls him a legendary prosecutor and says he was a wonderful man and committed to justice.
Let me just be clear. So you're saying that Roger King is this basically very aggressive ADA in Philly, and he's basically, we're throwing the book at you.
Right. And so this is the administration Suave is being prosecuted under. These kids are terrified of the death penalty, including Suave. And so he did take a deal, no jury trial, to remove the threat of the death penalty. And instead, his case was heard by one judge who will decide if Suave will go free or spend his life in prison.
Wait, but if you just go in front of a judge, then it's like you don't have to present the evidence to 12 human beings. I bet a lot of these cases would have been challenged. It would have been hard to get a conviction.
So there would have been a lot more scrutiny. And so that one judge sided with Sharon Benjamin's version of events. And that was it. Suave was arrested at 17, too young to vote, too young to drink, too young to serve in the military, but old enough to receive a sentence meant to guarantee he would die in prison. We'll be right back.
Support for Latino USA comes from Odoo. If you feel like you're wasting time and money with your current business software, or just want to know what you could be missing, then you need to join the millions of other users who switched to Odoo. Odoo is the affordable, all-in-one management software with a library of fully integrated business applications that help you get more done in less time for a fraction of the price. To learn more, visit odoo.com/latino. That's odoo.com/latino. Odoo, modern management made simple. Climate change affects everyone, but it doesn't affect everyone equally. Immigrants often bear a unique burden due to climate change, but they're also leading the way with impactful solutions. Feet in Two Worlds, the news outlet and journalism training organization for immigrant voices, presents Home Interrupted. from flooded basement apartments in New York City to indigenous Maya farming practices in Nebraska. Feet in Two Worlds, Home Interrupted brings you deeply reported original stories from across the United States. Episodes drop each week starting April 2nd. Find Feet in Two Worlds, Home Interrupted wherever you listen to podcasts.
We're back. Suave's early years in prison look a lot like his life on the streets of Philadelphia.
Woo! First of all, Greaterford was like, it was a big-ass prison. There was a lot of corruption, a lot of violence, just as it is. He comes into this prison.
My mom used to bring me drugs to the prison. That's how crazy I was. My mom used to bring me weed every week to the prison.
And he says he was getting the weed and selling it inside to other guys on the block.
I used to get money and send it home to my mom.
It's like Greaterford was, you know, it was just another version. It was the South Bronx, North Philly, and now Greaterford Maximum Security Prison. He just had to prove himself all over again.
There was chaos. Chaos. People was getting stabbed. People was getting their cells robbed. You had to be prepared for street wall at all times. That was the type of jail this was.
So Suave says he becomes that tough guy he always wanted to be. And he says the things he's doing land him in the hole, solitary confinement, over and over. Maria, even soon after his first meeting with you, he says he went into solitary for fighting with a guard.
You know, I didn't hear from Suave for years. So, what I came to understand is that when he was in solitary, it was pretty bad. Later, he would tell me that he spent 23 hours a day alone, locked down in a windowless cell, and that if he could get 1 hour of yard time, he would be so lucky.
And from time to time, you know, I used to find myself talking to myself in the hole. Like, you get lonely, guy. You there for years, you can't hear nothing but the guard when they open the door to feed you with a plastic tray. It is like, you know, you had these conversations with yourself. And people used to say, as long as you don't answer yourself back, you're not crazy. But that's just part of being in the hole then. And talking to the roaches when they walk by, you become, you want that little roach to come back every night. Because, you know, you look forward to that. That was like company.
Suave says at one point he starts talking with another man through the wall.
This older guy, he's been in the hole like 10 years at that time. And I used to ask him, can you write my letters for me? And he was like, no. But I'm going to show you how to read. This in the hole. And he used to give me a word every day. I used to memorize it, spell it back to him. I went in there without knowing how to read and write. And I came out of there knowing somewhat a couple of words. And that inspired me to keep going.
So when he gets out of solitary, he's determined to become fully literate by identifying letter by letter the words in the books he memorized. And that's when he decided to get a GED. And eventually, he enrolls in college.
He starts reading all the time, and he's like reading books about history, philosophy, law, pop culture.
And he's feeling good about his own education, and it starts to spread to his crew of friends.
I just decided that, you know what, I'm going to put my team, well, what I call my team, I'm going to put them all in college. And I built an organization where every board member in my organization had a college degree, and the jail couldn't understand it. They was like, what is you doing? I'm building a school. That's what I told the job, I'm building a school. I had plenty of people tell me, oh, the school, what do a degree in prison going to do for you? Absolutely nothing. Nothing. When I get my degree, I'm going to put it up in my wall to probably collect some dust. Don't do nothing in prison. But I use it to motivate other people that, man, you can have 100 years and you still go to school and educate yourself.
For a while, Suave took a job at Greater Ford's manufacturing plant, making uniforms.
I produce this here. This is what I produce all day long. Shirts, DOC.
This is a video produced by the Department of Corrections in 2001. It was later used in schools for youth crime prevention. Suave points to piles of neatly folded brown uniforms. There's dozens of piles, each nearly as tall as he is.
One inmate probably did all this in one day. All this right here. You could combine this. This is the equivalent to 25 cents worth of work right here.
So Suave and the men at the plant, they cut, sewed, and pressed hundreds of uniforms daily. And so this super repetitive task left Suave with so much time to think.
Right. I mean, you know, he's looking at these uniforms, like one after another, and he's thinking about, oh, this is for all the people, the men who they're expecting to come into this prison. And he's like, this has got to stop. Like, how does this stop? How does this cycle stop? And he really, like, zeroes in, becomes obsessed with education.
Most people that go to prisons are not hardcore criminals. Most people go to prison because they do stuff out of necessity. They just don't know the system. They don't know the law, so they get caught up. Do people change? Yes. I'm living proof of that.
And so he comes up with this idea to help at-risk teens who are in the community, and he wants to help with their schooling. And that then takes off to, like, oh, well, wait, let's create a scholarship program.
So I said, okay, I got to come up with the money. So what we did, we donated our own funds to the school district to start the scholarship.
So in 2008, Suave goes cell to cell asking men to donate from their commissary.
So I remember when Suave called me and he told me that this scholarship, you know, like I thought it was just an idea. Now he's calling and he's telling me that they have raised like a few hundred dollars in the first year. And, you know, that might not sound like a lot of money, you know, a few hundred dollars. But you have to remember, these are men who get paid 20 cents an hour to work inside the prison. To make a donation is a huge sacrifice, you know, for them. And it continued year after year. They continued to raise even more money and to donate it. And it was around this time that Suave starts writing novels about life in the hood. And eventually, this independent publisher begins printing his books. And Suave, from inside the prison, from being this illiterate guy, is now penning 6 novels of his own. And, you know, I don't want to give the false impression that everything was, you know, like going fabulously for Suave at this time, because, you know, the truth is, like, he was also having this moment where he's realizing he's a 40-year-old man who has never spent a single day of his adult life in the outside world. And so he knows that no matter how much he does right, he's still gonna die inside this prison.
What's college from?
Louis Suave Gonzalez. Hey buddy, I've been crying a whole lot lately.
And why are you crying so much now?
You know, because it really hurts me. Like, my family knew me as one person, and they don't really know who I am today. And, you know, and before, you know, I had this attitude when I was younger where real mans don't cry, and, you know, but that's a lie, because when these doors lock and you're in your cell and there's nobody around, believe me, you crying. And in the course of you being incarcerated with a life sentence, you're going to lose your mother, you're going to lose your father, you're going to lose family members, and you can't go to the funeral or you can't make a phone call, that you're feeling that pain.
So this is where Suave's at in 2017, when the Supreme Court ruled to have all juvenile lifer cases who were sentenced under mandatory laws reevaluated. Suave finally has a resentencing date, and his lawyers and prosecutors agreed on a deal to get him out. They're going to ask the judge to resentence Suave to 30 years in prison, a sentence he's already served. If the judge agrees, he can get out pretty much right away, but on lifetime parole, which is a very conditional kind of freedom. For most parolees, that means no drinking, no leaving the state without permission, drug tests, random home visits, and regular check-ins with a parole officer for the rest of your life. Suave initially doesn't want to do this. He knows lifetime parole means any mistake could land him back in prison. But in the end, he decides to accept a deal to get out. The judge just has to agree, and anything could happen. The wait is nerve-wracking.
How are you trying to stay centered?
After I'm done talking to you, I'm going back to my cell. I'm going to listen to my song, and I'm going to just relax and lock it in for the day.
When Suave says his song, he means the song Patience by Nas and Damian Marley, which you, Maria, introduced him to.
So I remember one time when Suave was having a really challenging moment. I mean, he was sad. And I was telling him about a song that has really helped me, you know, Patience by Nas. And Suave said, well, wait, I can listen to that song. He said, I have an MP3 player, which I didn't know. And I said, you know, we'll listen to it.
I got to remind myself, patience. And that's how I'm working now. You know, but do I want to go on the bar? Hell yeah. Hell yeah, but I don't expect them to make it easy. It's never been easy.
Finally, the day of resentencing arrives. It's July 6th, 2017, and Maria, you're on the Amtrak to Philadelphia. And the reality is setting in that this relationship you've had for decades from across prison bars could suddenly move into the real world.
It's this very strange experience that I have with this other human being, right? That I don't spend a lot of time thinking about Suave in my life. Like, I have an incredibly full life of work, travel, jobs, multiple jobs, husband, kids, you know, and Suave pops into my life with a phone call that I never know when it's going to come. You know, I'm thoughtful about what he's experiencing, and we talk about him at work, but in the last, you know, 48 hours, I've been finding myself like, what's he doing now? And now what is Suave doing? And now what's going to happen? I mean, this is mind-blowing.
One more thing you're thinking over to yourself on this train ride. Suave's request for you to speak on his behalf.
It was like something that I felt like I should do, because I actually, you know, can under oath just talk about my experience with this person. But then, you know, I have really super smart journalist colleagues, and they were like, no, you can't, for all kinds of reasons.
You know, it's complicated because, you know, I have to acknowledge I'm reporting on Suave, right? I'm reporting on him at this point. I'm recording our phone calls. I can't get involved with a source like that. So that's like an issue. And also, you know, I don't really know him outside of prison. So what if something does happen when he gets out and I'm on the record?
As you arrive at the courthouse, you have to turn your recorder off. There's no recording allowed inside.
Just after 3 o'clock, you know, everybody's kind of rushed in. Finally, it's like, get in. And everybody sits down. You know, the room was full, actually. It was pretty much packed. Most of us, you know, strangers to each other, but everybody there for the same reason. And Suave walks into the courtroom. Oh my God, he looked horrible. His face looked horrible. He looked like he hadn't slept. He looked like he hadn't eaten. He looked like he had been crying. And, you know, Suave is this big guy. He's like a football player, big, with these broad shoulders. He's like 5'11", 250 pounds. And he's wearing this huge suit that was way too baggy. And he never turned his head, never even lifted his head to look at any of us. I mean, you know, I was like, surely he's going to turn around and, you know, look for me. Nada, nothing at all.
Well, again, so the DA put the 30-year deal on the table, but the judge could still say no. He must have been really nervous.
We were all nervous because, you know, just like one single judge had decided if Suave was going to spend his life in prison when he was 17, now here he is at 47, and another single judge is going to decide if he's going to get a second chance at life.
Finally, the judge enters. She asks Suave if there's anything he wants to tell the court before she reveals her decision. Again, we recreated this moment from the transcripts. Your Honor, Suave begins.
I, Luis Gonzalez, feel sincerely grief and express remorse for causing the death of Daniel Martinez. I could not imagine the amount of grief and pain the family have suffered as a result of my actions. I felt tremendous guilt then, and I still do now. The day Mr. Martinez died, the irresponsibility of Luis Gonzalez died also. I've felt remorse every day since because I'm aware of the ripple effect of my actions. To not allow Mr. Martinez to be in vain, I realize I have to continue taking on the challenges of becoming an instrument of love and kindness, as well as becoming a crusader to end violence in our community. I'm sorry I failed each and every one of you as a man, brother, uncle, a friend, and most of all, a citizen. To my mother, I'm sorry you never got the chance to see your only son become a responsible man. I'm sorry for being an embarrassment to the family. I only hope that one day I'm able to serve my community with integrity, honor, and respect.
I now resentence the defendant Luis Gonzalez on the charge of murder in the first degree to 30 years to life.
Oh my God. Oh my God. I was like, oh my God, I can't believe this. If he's sentenced to 30 years, he's already done 30 years, which means he's going to get out. I mean, he's going to be able to go straight to parole. The judge just made this happen. All of these years, and I just saw her say this, you have been resentenced to 30 years. Boom. He's going to get out.
You set the bar high. You said, I can do much with the gifts I've been given. We're going to look forward to that.
This episode was produced by Julieta Martinelli and Maggie Freeling and edited by Audrey Quinn. Suave, the podcast, is a production of Futuro Studios, distributed by PRX. The executive editor is Marlon Bishop, fact-checking by Amy Tardif. Subscribe to the Suave podcast to listen to what happens next. Just search for the word Suave wherever you get your podcasts on. The Latino USA team includes Miguel Macias, Andrea López Cruzado, Marta Martínez, Alisa Escarce, Ginny Montalvo, Alejandra Salazar, Reynaldo Leaños Jr., and Julia Rocha, with help from Raúl Pérez. Our engineers are Stephanie Lebeau, Julia Caruso, and Leah Shaw, with help from Elizabeth Itu. Our digital editor is Luis Luna. Our interns are Samantha Friedman and Carly Rubin. Our theme music was composed by Zenia Rubinos. If you like the music you heard on this episode, be sure you stop by latinousa.org and check out our weekly Spotify playlist. I'm your host and executive producer, Maria Hinojosa. Join us again on our next episode. And in the meantime, look for us on all of your social media. Ahí los guacho. Hasta la próxima. Chao.
Latino USA is made possible in part by the Heising Simons Foundation, unlocking knowledge, opportunity, and possibilities. More at hsfoundation.org. The Art for Justice Fund, a special project of Rockefeller Philanthropy Advisors. And the Ford Foundation, working with visionaries on the front lines of social change worldwide.
You made fried chicken?
Yes. and some fried cauliflower.
I can't make fried chicken.
You don't know how to cook fried chicken, Maria? I cook. I give you a delicious jailhouse chicken.
I'm Maria Hinojosa, and next time on Latino USA, my conversation with multi-Grammy award-winning artist and Puerto Rican icon, Jose Feliciano. That's next time on Latino USA.